sure they have that clip.
Log Talk Radio.
By national origin.
I went and tried to get some stuff from the state because I never could find it, and then finally someone got back to me.
Oh, good.
And I see where they had some recommendation, but no, it takes a while to read all this stuff.
It certainly does. I peruse their site on a daily basis, and it's not user friendly
right.
at all. And you would think, like, certain search words are pretty. I know the lingo.
Mm-hmm.
And it, yeah, never takes you anywhere close to what I'm looking for.
Right.
And I have kind of figured it out, but there is so much good information
yes.
on that site and comparative analysis, and that's all. What I like to see and the spread over the years. And so there it is. That's a great site, but you have to figure it out.
You really have to look.
The best place to look are the downloads. There's a section that says downloads.
Okay.
Everything. That's what I figured out. So instead of trying to find like a budget, so budget, financial budget, you would say budget, finance report. I tried everything. Go to the downloads, and there's a whole list of things you can click on and find. So. That's one.
Well, that's good advice.
Yeah. And you wouldn't really, I don't know,
I wouldn't have thought of that.
Logically, think that, but hours and hours later.
It was the thing that, that Hattie said, I'm going to let you do that. You know, you sent me something.
Yeah. There is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make sure I was getting
Nicole said.
Is that right? Okay.
So then origin.
From the board.
Yeah. Okay.
Nicole Randolph.
Right.
What's her name, Nicole?
Yes.
I don't know.
No, I got it here, but he also wrote something. So I
remember.
It's
not going to matter. We're not being so. It's not going to matter if I'm over here. There's no space. I can't stand.
I'll still make
it.
It's
not in there. I hate my phone.
Oh no.
You got it?
Yeah.
Be careful.
Don't touch any buttons, girl.
Americans from all walks of life must be concerned and work diligently to eliminate this undignified stain on our system. Educators especially must work with a relentless effort to eliminate this immoral situation at all costs. I know that Rome was not built in a day, but the years of existence of this intolerable situation is a disgrace to educators, our educational systems, and our nation as a whole. I believe that we must bridge the gaps between local and national organizations, communities, businesses, unions, teachers, administrators, and parents to create a collaborative effort to work together to end this disparity in educational outcomes. As the president of the Minnesota Alliance of Black School Educators, NAPSE, I extend the invitation to all who are willing to work together in a common effort to find a resolution to put an end to what is known as the academic achievement gap with Godspeed. Also, I would like to thank the NAACP Director of Education, the Minneapolis School Board members, and the MAPSE members this year, as well as yourselves. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to be here for this important discussion. Hopefully, we can use this effort to develop a synergy to move forward collectively and address this issue with vigor, commitment, and unity necessary to bring this alarming predicament to a halt. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give him a hand. We brought in some ringers, as well as the members of the executive board and members of the Minnesota Alliance of Black School Educators. And I'd like to start here at this end with Ms. Rebecca Gagnon and have you introduce yourself. And if you guys take about 30 seconds, please, to go down, and the audience will get to know you as we go here. So thank you.
My name is Rebecca Gagnon. I'm one of the newly seated directors on the Minneapolis Board of Education. About a month into the job, and I am just looking forward, as Mr. Salisbury said, to a collaborative effort.
Good evening, Nicole Randolph, national member of MAPSE. I am here as a community member, a mother, and also an educator in Minneapolis Public Schools.
Hi, Kim Ellison, the newly appointed education chair of the Minneapolis NAACP. I'm also here as a mother of four, an educator in the alternative schools, and a parent.
My name is Diane Thomas, and I have been in education for over 20 years. I've worked in Chicago Public Schools, the Minneapolis School District, as well as Osseo School District. I am concerned about the achievement gap for any child who is not living to their greatest potential academically, emotionally, and socially. So there is hope, and that's where we come in.
I'm Mary Whitney. I'm MAPSE Vice President of the Board. I'm also a community educator working with a lot of men, women, and youth sometimes who are coming out of corrections, doing self-esteem and relationships training, because education is a right, a civil right to be for all families, and especially those who have been less privileged to learn.
Good evening, and I'm Hattie Bonds, and I am a Minneapolis Public School Administrator. I have had children in the Minneapolis Public School, so I look at it from multi-facets, and I am just one for equality and justice for children, and certainly to help and improve everyone's educational experience with wherever I work. I have worked in the Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools prior to coming to Minneapolis.
Thank you very much. And let's give everyone on the panel a hand, please. I don't have a clap sign here, so I'm going to cue you on that.
but let me just do this. on the panelists who remember this scenario. One of my roles is I'm the timekeeper. And so I will be the arbitrator to make sure you don't go too long. Thank you.
Before we get going, I'd like to just make a statement on the slide there. Minnesota school districts are faced with many challenges, and the Twin Cities school administrators are faced with the decisions including closing schools, charter schools, teacher certification, and retention. Tonight's forum addresses causal reasons why the achievement gap has skyrocketed for children of color, who in most cases are left behind. And before we go on, Donna Ford is a professor of special education at Vanderbilt University, and she has some very important things to say. And we're only going to listen to this like 15 minutes, but we're not going there. We'll listen to the first 2 minutes in about 30 seconds, which she really puts her foot in it and states the case, and then we'll move on to the presentation.
Why do you think there seems to be an achievement gap between students of different races?
A lot of explanations have been given about why the achievement gap exists. And it primarily exists between black students and white students, and between Hispanic students and white students. And you can place those variables in a couple of categories. One category is what takes place at home, you know, what are the parents doing that might contribute to the achievement gap. And then the other one is what takes place at school in terms of contributing to the achievement gap. At school, lack of rigor is the number one variable, according to research, that contributes to the achievement gap. And lack of rigor is fundamentally about teacher expectations. Even if you have solid curriculum on paper, the school district has done spent a lot of money and a lot of time designing this curriculum. When it's actually implemented, that's when it matters. So if you're a teacher who has low expectations for children who live in poverty or low expectations for culturally diverse students, then you will deliver low quality instruction. Also, things in the school relate to resources like teacher experience, teacher credentials or quality, it will be called, computers in the classroom or lack thereof, the learning environment not feeling safe for students. Those are some of the top reasons that the achievement gap exists, at least from the school perspective. Then when it comes to the home, you have families not being involved in school as they need to, or just not being around their presence, not being around the kids and controlling or overlooking, you know, what they're doing, how they're spending their time, not reading to the children or not having them read, letting them watch too much television, meaning not monitoring what they're watching on television. And then from the health perspective, we look at lead poisoning. We look at low birth weight, and then you look at hunger and nutrition as well. So there are at least 14 major variables that, again, fall to the school category, fall to the home category that contribute to the achievement gap.
Let's go back to what you were talking about in the very beginning.
That said, we're going to start off with the panel, and the first question or discussion we can have, and you guys can chime in. Raise your hand. I'll just go ahead. African-American boys and girls are more likely to be ignored in the classroom and classified with a behavioral problem or special needs. Under the color of law, if education is a civil right, who enforces the law? More importantly, how does this affect the achievement gap? And who would like to take that? I mean, I could direct. Ms. Thomas?
I think in the classroom, a lot of times students already have a deficit in their learning, so they tend to act out in class to cover up for the deficit in their learning. Also, it's not cool in a junior high to be smart or to participate in class, and I think that contributes to students falling further and further behind. Teachers have to become aware of cultural competence, look at the whole child, do a child scan, find out why this child is behaving that way, assess what their child's academic level is. Can this child read? Has this child eaten today? Is this child experiencing other problems in the community or with other students as well? So you have to look at a number of variables with the student who is not achieving or participating and becoming a behavior problem.
And would anybody else on the panel like Ms. Gagnon, please?
I think there is a lack of recognition of the cultural difference of how we all learn and how we all participate. Not everybody grows up in an environment where you let one person talk. My family, we talk over each other. Not everyone grows up in an environment where you raise your hand. You get excited. You jump in. So I think, and some teachers just are not used to that. So I think we really have to be aware of what's a behavior problem and what is just a learning style or an exuberance about what they're learning. And I think the health issues are a huge thing when kids are coming to school not feeling well. They're not usually in the best mood to be respectful. So I think the health issues are another big part of the problem.
Ms. Bond?
Yes. There was a professor, he did some research, and I think it was at Bella State University, and he talked about kids going into special education for three reasons, and one of them being movement, which would be considered somewhat of a cultural competency piece in terms of some children are more active than others, and that can be perceived as being a special or EBD type of a child. The other part that he talked about was the language piece. So in other words, children that perhaps talk a little bit differently, they don't use the King's language in the same way that some of their teachers use it, they will be perceived as being not as bright or brilliant. And then the last piece he talked about was children that were perhaps they came to school not maybe bathing because of poverty issues. Maybe their water is off. Maybe they're homeless or whatever. But those were the three things that he talked about. So in terms of kids being in special education and then people having the teachers and those administrators and all the staff in that building, looking at children as being bright, intelligent, and giving them the rigor they need regardless of the language, regardless of the movement, and regardless of their appearance would really serve us better.
Okay, thank you. And then for a final comment on this question, we'll go to Ms. Randolph, and then on the next slide, we'll be starting with Ms. Ellison.
When you ask the question who enforces the law should be enforced by parents, school administrators who are involved with students who may have special education needs, which could be disabilities. And it runs the gamut, and really it is a parent's job to seek out an advocate if they're not familiar with the process, even before they sign documentation, that through this very thorough assessment of this child, you can find out some key information and advocate that child receives those services at school. So there is a stigma to special education as if it's negative and it always directly associated with behavioral problems when we're referencing African-American children or students of color, but there's a wide range, and the only way that your child will receive the appropriate services or you have an opportunity to change those services is for parents to be aware, to read those documents, and to ask for an advocate or a school social worker to go through that step by step with you.
Thank you very much, Ms. The next slide. Students are missing learning if they're not in school. Black male and female students are suspended and expelled at a higher rate than non-black students. Why does this happen, and how can black educators and assistants solve this challenge? Ms. Ellison, please.
You know, yes, this does happen, and not just black educators, but I think all educators, before they walk into a classroom, think they need to do some self-reflection, you know, kind of unpack themselves. What are they carrying? What are some of the things they grew up believing? And before they take it into the classroom and project that onto the students, you know, they need to be able to go in with this clean board and be able to see the students as learners and there to learn and be able to serve what the students need at that time.
Thank you. President Salisbury, please.
Well, I got a kind of echo. Echoing that, I don't think that we can look at it in the sense of black. All educators, and I mentioned that in my opening statement, all educators. Education should be neutral grounds. We should have no color, race, or any of that as educators. Once we get to that point where, first, we need to examine ourselves as educators. We need to examine ourselves as communities, as people, and start to looking for answers collectively together. Because if we continue to look in the corners of the crevices across this nation based on race, for the 50 years or more that we have not found the solution, I fear that we will not.
Thank you. Ms. Whitney, we haven't heard from you yet. I'm just trying to be fair across the board there.
Well, as a mother who had her child eventually label attention deficit disorder, it wasn't until I moved in from Minneapolis to Savage that those things happened. And as Ms. Bonds was sharing earlier, a lot of times it's because a child may move differently within a classroom or may act differently within a classroom, they begin to get labeled. And instead of looking for deficits, it would be better for us to look at the assets that every child brings to a classroom. Every child wants to learn, and we all learn at different capacities. And if we don't, as teachers, sometimes act as social workers too, we will lose the children between the gaps.
Thank you. Ms. Gadden, please.
Thank you. To add to the social work comment, which I completely agree, is more mental health services in the schools. I think we discipline needs to be turned on its head, and we need to find the source of the problems, kids coming to school hungry, whatever's going on at home. And I do agree with Mr. Salisbury on his point. To an extent, I believe that teachers in the classroom need to have highest expectations of every child in the classroom, regardless of what they look like, what they bring into the classroom. But we also need to be very aware that our children do bring different beliefs and different styles, many times based on race or religion, into the classroom. And we need to be conscious of that when teaching.
Okay. In my experience, it has to do with cultural competence and cultural responsiveness. First, teachers have to look at their own culture, their values, and their traditions and beliefs, because that would impact how they respond to students of color. At the same time, students of color must learn how to code switch. What is acceptable at home may not be acceptable in school. So how do we as educators help students make that code switch and at the same time look at our own culture and how we are imposing what we believe and feel on that particular or that particular group of students? So I think we have to go to that soul searching first and then take time to get to know the students, understand the environment that they're living in, and how we can support them. Because kids want to please you, they really do, but they also know that if you don't care for them, and they will tell you, you don't care about me, why should I learn? So they will live up to our expectations, but we have to be cognizant of their needs.
Thank you very much. Thank you. The next two questions, the format is the following. First of all, it will give you an opportunity on the screen to read it and digest it. We will start with Ms. Bond and finish with the only elected official that we have. The second question will be in reverse. So I want to give you a brief one, if you will. The achievement gap. There's been much discussion in America There's been much discussion globally. Some maintain there is no answer to this problem in America. We do this for our international audience because many in other parts of the world cannot understand that America doesn't have all the answers to solve the problem. Surprise, we don't. Starting with human bonds, the achievement gap, closing the gap, and is it a possibility and a reality?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to answer that question. I really appreciate that. I really think, and I'm optimistic, that there is a chance that we can close the achievement gap. And the reason I say that is because there are some developing countries, they don't have near the amount of resources that we have here in this country, and yet they have literacy. It is very high. Why aren't we closing it? Some of the reasons that people have said so far. The huge cultural competency issue. And to be very honest with you, I think that education has become big business. With it becoming big business, because we have very few natural resources in our country at this time, that's where our natural resources are, our children. And until we, I think, take a look at it from the humanitarian standpoint as well as the academic standpoint, then we're not going to get very far because we're not dealing with things, we're dealing with people. So until we can do all of those kinds of things, and I think that would be the catalyst for doing that. I mean, we've done that in the past, but now, and I was a part of the No Child Left Behind sculpturing of that. The National Alliance of Black School Educators did a huge policy piece out in Washington, D.C. We went there. We sat in rooms, and we talked about how do we do this, and we did not want to let the suburban school districts off the hook. So how do we sculpt it so that everybody is held accountable for all of the children learning, including kids of color, whereas before, everything else, all the other programs are the Education Secondary, Elementary and Secondary Ed Act, let some of the other people off the hook. They only dealt with the inner city schools, and those are in poverty. So
thank
I
you.
Hope that answers.
If I was to be advised, I would very quietly hold my hand up like this.
I wanted to say for me, I will always come from a different perspective because I'm not a teacher within the regular school system. I'm a community peer educator, so my answer may be different. And I see that a lot of times the system is already set up for kids to fail who may not be at a particular level coming in. And we may not always have funds or dollars to buy the crayons and the nice pencils and the pin sets that schools don't always have to share with kids. And right away, that will make the child feel bad and less apt to be able to come up to a certain standard. So right there, they're already feeling harmed and at a deficit. And so a lot of times when they go into a shell and maybe not say anything, you think they're acting out or they're being bad. And really, they're ashamed because they can't be the same as other kids. And so I just think that education is the responsibility of all of us as parents, as teachers, and parents going to the kids, parent and teachers conferences and all those things. Every parent doesn't do that. To find a way to reach community people who are not always in the school with their kids as well. And I think it can be changed. And I do believe that we can help all children. Are we willing to not make them a commodity and make them assets?
Thank you. President Salzberg?
Yeah. You know, part of the question was whether we can do it in our lifetimes. And when we were listening to Dr. Ford, she was saying that rigor, expectations. If we don't believe that we can do it as educators, with all of the degrees that we put on the table, if we don't believe it, then we're leaving it to our children. So I say we have to start talking in the positive rather than in the negative. It's up to us. I believe we can. I believe it could be done tomorrow, and that might be a little over, but as far as I can see, if I cannot believe when I walk into a classroom, I don't believe a kid can learn, then I don't believe that I can teach. So what we got to start to doing is getting away from the negative. If we're going to talk about rigor and expectations in our curriculums, then we better start believing in ourselves. And first and foremost, and I'll leave it at that, we better believe that we can stick together to solve this problem or find some type of collaboration to do so.
Yeah, I believe that we can, and there are school districts that are doing it. In St. Louis Park, in the high school, they are working with kids, closing the achievement gap. In my own school, we are closing the achievement gap. What are we doing? As a system, we are aligning our policies and our practices with the goal that we want to achieve. And we are all sending the same message that it's not about you, teacher. It's not about you, administrator. It's about that student. So you're going to have to work to help that student be successful, and we're going to work as a team. We're going to involve the community. We're going to involve the families. We're going to involve businesses. We're going to involve agencies. It takes all of us to work together to help the students. We are now engaging in mentorships for kids. I believe all kids should have a mentor. All kids, according to the Research Institute, should have 7 adults in their life. I think we should try to utilize the research that we have and use that research to drive all of our efforts to helping to close the achievement gap. I think also we have to look at the suspensions. There are high rate of suspensions for Afro-Americans. Let's look at some alternatives for the suspension. Let's have a room, let's have an in-school behavior room where you help them with the academics, you help them with conflict resolution, you help them know how they fit in that environment, in the school environment, how they fit in their home environment.
Okay.
Yes, can we solve this problem of the achievement gap in our lifetimes? Absolutely we can. When I was teaching, when the first high-stake tests came out, the Minnesota Basic Standards test, that all students had to pass before they would get a high school diploma. You had to test in eighth grade, and if you didn't pass it, you had to test every year until you passed it, or you wouldn't get your diploma in 12th grade. I was teaching at an alternative school in St. Paul, and it was very important for the Minnesota Department of Education to be able to say, this is the percentage of students within the state who are passing this test by grade level. This is the percentage of students passing the test by district, and this is the percentage of students passing the test by school. As an alternative school, it was kind of off the radar, but our principal put the same type of document together, and she said, you know, one thing it showed her is we were below what the state was doing in the eighth, ninth grade years. By 10th grade, we were passing a higher percentage of students than the state was, but still lower than the district. By 11th and 12th grade, the percentage of students passing the test in our school was higher than what the district was doing. One, it showed us that if we held on to the students long enough, the students could pass the test. And so it goes back to the mobility. We need to help stabilize the students, and two, that they can learn. We had counselors on staff, and my teacher would tell them, you know, the principal would say, I've got wonderful teachers in the classroom who can teach the students. The students can learn. I need the counselors to make sure the students are in the classroom to learn. So.
I'd like to just turn this achievement gap on its head for a minute and give you a little homework. When do we start talking about the achievement gap? That's one question for us all to consider. When did it become so popular? And what has happened since we have talked about the achievement gap? One other point of reference I'd like to make is that
African Americans chose as a profession from the 1890s up to the 1980s, the number went from 15,000 to 362,000. That means people who look like us were choosing that as a profession. It has declined to what number? I don't know, but we know this has been a drastic decline. The other thing I'd like to bring up right here in our own Minneapolis, Dr. Davenport, who is at the University of Minnesota, who teaches a SAT class, talked about information bias. You know, we want to tell our children these tests are biased. That's why you have trouble passing them. They're not biased. They're information biased, access. The other thing, so in reference to the achievement gap, can we achieve this in our lifetime? Yes, it's through enrichment. It is our responsibility. You know, education is a civil right, but every one of us in here has a responsibility to teach our children why it is important. And so I question us, have we made that attempt? Have we talked to them about the sacrifice? Do they understand what the value of an education is before they walk in the door? Do we mentor children and help them to understand that they are not working from a deficit, they're working from an asset model? They are asset model. Those are some of the things I think that we need to look at as educators and members of the community.
Thank you. Every child can achieve. This is why I ran for school board, because every child can achieve. We need to get our kids into the schools prepared, and Minneapolis Public Schools is doing a much better job in early childhood education, but we need community support to do more because we're still not able to reach every child. I agree with the panel on the holistic approach to educating children. We must understand all of their needs. If their basic needs are met, then they can sit in the classroom and learn and not be worried or hungry or tired. In the past years, it seems that Minneapolis Public Schools in particular has focused on the diversity in the schools. The state has focused on the diversity in schools, which everyone agrees. A diverse school, children learn better and get a better education. But that has proven to be unsuccessful. Our high schools currently in Minneapolis, we have one high school that's below 30% children of color, one that's right above it, and the other five are around 80% students of color. So it has been ineffective, and I think our focus must shift to equity. Equity in our schools, equitable programs, but most importantly, equitable outcomes, which does not mean equal funding, which does not mean equal attention to certain schools and certain students. And I think equity in the long run fills our schools up, and everyone will start to choose, and that will create the diversity in and of itself.
Thank you. Now, the next question here, I'm asking you to kind of combine the reason, and I'll start in with Director Gagnon and work back to Myra. And by the way, when we get done with PowerPoint, we're going to give the community an opportunity to ask some questions here.
Hey.
Okay, can everyone hear me now?
Good. He said there will be a Q&A.
Yeah, there will be a Q&A. Okay. When we look at the data, we are not educating a lot of our children. Yet we continue to stick our heads in the sand and try to hide the truth by not reporting the data in transparent ways. Who here can change that? It appears that when we start down the road, that might be more effective. We turn around because it makes many people uncomfortable. Hold that thought. Much has been said about using the business model to educate our children. When we look at corporate America and all of its recent problems, why should we travel that road? Should we learn from their mistakes? How about a model of accountability that works for people, not millions?
Oh, it's my turn. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Nicole. Are we answering the data question or the widgets question? The data. Okay. So who here can change the data reporting? You know, it's an interesting thing. So many things nowadays are data-driven decision-making. Everything needs to be based upon data, but what is the data and who's controlling the data and what factors are going into those measurements? Are we measuring growth? Are we measuring a point in time? Are we measuring this class of kids against another class of kids, which we do with the MCAs, and we score the schools, which is a bit illogical. And the other thing, when the state says, well, you have to pass these tests to graduate, well, if you don't pass it after two tries, then you can take this one class, and then you can graduate. Are the children really prepared to graduate? They're not retested. We don't know any more about what knowledge they have. So, yes, the data doesn't exactly reflect what we think it reflects sometimes. So digging deep, we all control the data. We need to ask the questions, and it's there. The breakdown of the data is there, and we need to understand it from the ground level.
Thank you. Ms. Randolph, please.
I'm going to actually step back a little bit before I even try to address the question of should we be looking at it as a business or how should we refine or reform what we're doing. When we talk about the achievement gap, some of us are talking about college entry, who's getting into college, who's there. Some of us are talking about early childhood or elementary or secondary education. Some of us don't want to talk about the incarceration rate, and some of us don't want to talk about racism. So if you want to talk about the achievement gap, you need to think about from which perspective you're talking about, as well as I feel in terms of testing and data are just like statistics. You can make your numbers say what you want them to say, but there are some basics that we have gotten away from, and we have many of our school systems who consistently adopt new curriculum, and then they abandon it when it doesn't prove the data that they would like to show within 1 year. We know that it takes a number of years in order to see growth, but again, when we're talking about children of color, if we would take time, again, to build up those cultural competencies within themselves, that is the foundation in which they need to be successful, and it's about giving them the richness. And I am speaking in reference to African-American children in particular, as well as children of color. When we stop looking for the Western world and European views to tell us how well our children learn and how well they succeed, we will begin to help reframe our thinking, which will help them to believe that they can achieve.
Ms. Ellison, please.
I'm going to skip the question on data and talk about the widget question. And, you know, absolutely not. Children are not widgets. And we need to be looking at the whole child. We talked a little bit about children coming to the school hungry or tired. They haven't bathed. We need to be looking at what is keeping them from doing these basic things that need to get done before they're even in a state where they can learn. We need to be helping the students. And then when we get them to that place, we need to be teaching them unconditionally. Not, okay, you know, you're going to look good in my eyes if you can pass this test or if you do well on this assignment. We need to make sure that the students understand that, you know, we care about them no matter how well they do on the test, and we want to help them do better.
I'd like to address who can change data reporting. I think we all can change that from the State Department, who lists data that if you go to school reports, you can find a lot of data about different schools and different school districts as well. I think that parents ought to be educated to how to assess that information so it's not difficult to look through their website. I'm an educator. And I'm computer literate, and I had to search. So we should make it more easily user-friendly for anyone to use. We should also, when we have parent meetings, we should educate our parents about what this data means, because data should be driving everything we do. So we must have also that common standards. What does an A mean? Are we grading because of behavior? Are we grading because they show up? Or are they meeting certain competencies? So we want to be clear on what students are mastering. And we need to, as parents and as educators, make sure we continue to have that discussion, that we use our media, Facebook, Twitter, and whatever, and get the information out to those that we serve. And a lot of times, parents don't understand what this data means. And so that's why it's really important that we educate parents. It's not scary. It's only scary because you don't really understand it. Usually if we're talking about it, you'll see people doing this, but they don't really know what you're talking about. And it's kind of embarrassing. But everybody has to learn. So we should make that our goal, from the State Department to the superintendents to the principals to the parent organizations, all visible.
Thank you, Mike. I think when we start talking about this whole concept, we better be careful that we don't throw the baby out with the water, because we need to look at all models and we need to look at everything that's out there to figure out how we're missing this thing for so long. When I was in corporate America, there's one thing that I did learn. It's called R2A2. It's called recognize, relate, assimilate, and then act. So I think that what we need to do is to R2A2. We need to recognize, because the data is already telling us we got a problem. Then we need to relate how we're going to deal with it, and then we need to assimilate by organizing and drawing a plan and then do some action. And I leave it at that.
Thank you. Ms. Whitney, please.
I wanted to say the data that changed my way of thinking about education was when I found out 10 years ago that 68% of the young men between 11 and 20 who were incarcerated for murder were there because they killed their mother's abuser. And we never really talk about how abuse is affecting the lives of our children when they enter the school system, how homelessness is affecting our children when they enter the school system. If we have one in every three African-American boys, one in six Latinos, and one in 17 white children ending up incarcerated throughout their lifetime, we really have a problem here. And I believe we need to build more schools than prisons. And many of the children, you would never know that their parent may be incarcerated because of the shaming effect upon that child. We really need to do all that we can as a community. That 650,000 individuals who are incarcerated, two-thirds are back before 3 years are up. We need to change those numbers. And if a mother can't read, then the child can't read. So I believe we as community need to come together. Instead of discussing the achievement gap, alleviate it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Whitney. Ms. Bonds, please.
Okay, I'm going to take it a little bit different approach, and I'm going to address the data piece as well. And as Ms. Thomas said, those of us who know the systems well are having a hard time sometimes finding the data. There was a time that the State Department of Education, they had all of those different pieces of data, very accessible. You can pull up the school, look at it, had beautiful charts, very understandable for anybody who had a little bit of knowledge about that. So now that is not the case. So why is that? That would be my question on the data piece. And data, it's like why do we use it in the way that we use it? Why couldn't we use the data in a way? Data is very good, but how you use it is really the important thing. Even with the No Child Left Behind Act, why wouldn't we use that data to improve children rather than sometimes be punitive to the schools or what have you? So that's my piece on the data. As far as the widget piece, I think that in terms of humanity, widgets, we're using a lot of business models now in education. And I would say that, yes, we need to take a look at accountability. I want to be held accountable. But at the same time, we don't want to make some mistakes that the business world has made as well. So how do we learn from them and yet use the wisdom of elders and people that have the humanity piece that's there. So I think just blending those pieces together, let's say from the business world and the educational world, because across the nation there's a huge there is a huge business model.
And this is for our radio audience real quick, and I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Edwards. You're listening to On Point on Blog Talk Radio. Got to pay the bills.
The next two questions are somewhat loaded to the extent of the political agenda that resides in our city. Ms. Ellison, who is the chair of the Education Committee at NAACP, said something that was very compelling, and it has to do with priority. And her reflection was about the existence of a third world within the first world. We are the most prosperous nation on the face of the earth. We know that to be so because of all the stimulus money that comes around. And in the course of that, she reflected on children who come to school tired, hungry, and unbathed. Now, if we didn't know any different, we would expect that that was a scenario in a third world nation. As you pointed out, this is a scenario in a suburb of St. Paul. Consequently, starting at this end with our elected official, what is the priority? What is the importance of the priority in the survival of our children? Now, the district, as you can see along the board, is in the process of dealing with, I'm using my own personal bias, of building a new Crystal Palace called the school district headquarters. This is a district that has encumbered some debt, to say the least. I assume they have a plan to deal with that, but they also have a plan to go ahead with the Crystal Palace. Now, a month or so ago, they were given what was called a community benefits agreement, which allows for the full inclusion of communities to be involved in the economic growth. Someone said just minutes ago that unfortunately education is about business, big business. It's not always about big profit, i.e. debt. Consequently, starting with Gagnon and Chu, what is the priority? What is the priority table 7? What is the priority with the board? And what should be the expectation of priority within the community that has to be served?
Speaking for myself, and I do believe that also at the district level, the priority is educating children and making sure every child achieves. And so now to get off my political podium, my parents used to say all the time, do what I say, not what I do. And it didn't occur to me until I was a parent of how absolutely ridiculous that was. And so we can say many times, and I believe it to be true, that, you know, this pot of money is restricted and it's coming from an account that we can't use otherwise, and it is costing us a fortune to be at 807 because that building is falling down around us. And, you know, we hit the market at a great time, got great deals, great loans, so forth and so on, to build a building. But the perception of we are possibly $35 to $40 million in debt next year, and a teacher's contract just completed, and achievement still an enormous issue. We are maybe the bottom three states in the country on achieve 2. Thank you, Troy Parker. The bottom two states in the nation on achievement. That's why I have him here with me. And we also are the most segregated. Minneapolis, the most segregated city in the Midwest, and one of the most more segregated in the nation. So our priority, it has to be achievement. It has to be our children, but it has to be our communities, because we can't do it without our communities.
Thank you. By the way, we flip-flop with the state of Mississippi, if I'm not mistaken. Ms. Randall, as it pertains to being in the worst possible condition.
They're above us?
Well, we flip-flop.
Oh, lovely.
It depends on the timing of the annual report.
Okay. In reference
to the Minneapolis Public School building, the building, really, I have no comment on that. My concern is students, whether they build this building or not. My students have needs. And I have some of the students, and forgive me, but I want you to know that the children who are part of this achievement gap come from middle-class homes, two black parents, college degrees, biracial families. So, you know, we can stop talking about kids who have not eaten, they haven't been bathed, because we're failing the other children as well. Look at Anoka County. So it's a bigger issue. So the priority really is about how active are we going to get to, and how angry are we going to get and try to educate African-American children, Latino children, and other children of color.
Thank you. Ms. Ellis?
Yeah, I don't know much about the building of the new headquarters, but again, it's about the children. For me, that's how I see it. We need to educate the children. If the building helps the administrators support the teachers better, who are then in the classroom with the students, then, you know, I don't see if there's a problem with that.
I have no comment about Minneapolis and their building a building, but I would like to see funds go towards professional development for teachers, those who are most influential and important to student learning. So I guess I did say something, didn't I? I think that it's critical that we focus our monies into professional development, because we want to make sure that they have the knowledge and competence to help students achieve. Also, I think the priority is to inspire kids with the confidence and courage to achieve their dreams. And we as adults, we as managers in the school, as administrators, as parents and teachers, we influence kids every day that they come into our building. You influence them every day at the church, at the movie house. You are one of their biggest influence. So it's very important what we say and do.
Thank you. Thank you.
Salbert. I'm going to just kind of follow up on that. We ought to walk our talk. And first and foremost, it is the education of our children, and it is the future of our nation. Because if we continue to go down this path, we are going to corrode the whole nation. You know, we got to get real about what we're doing here. We keep on looking at the negativity in our children. I would suggest that some of us, and all of us, as a matter of principle, look in the mirror, reflect on ourselves. Why can we not end this thing? We have our children across the nation building better games than we can build coalitions to stick together to wipe out this nonsense academic achievement gap. It's about our children, and that's where we need to be.
I don't really want to comment on the building because I don't know that much about it. We have a $6 billion deficit here in the state of Minnesota, and to spend $35 million on a building, to me, was heart-wrenching when we have children who are hungry and homeless. And kids who have a mind to learn and be taught. And just because you're homeless, just because you don't have the same kind of clothes as everyone else, doesn't stop you from learning and taught and have dreams and passion and vision. And we as community can volunteer and mentor these children. And I've done 5,300 hours of community service myself, free. Not free, though, because they give me something back. Any child we teach, we mentor, we help, mother, father, children, sister, brother. We as a community, it's not a color thing, because I have a son who's interracial. So I'm not struck on color. I'm struck on business of changing children's lives and people's lives, and all of us together are in this. And when we can do that, the gaps will close.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will say that since the new district building is the order of the day, it would behoove us to take a look at who's going to be gaining from the construction of that building. We talked about kids being hungry. We talked about kids not having adequate facilities to live in. We talked about a lot of poverty. And yet, is it the chicken before the egg? If African American men and women have jobs to feed their children, they will feed them. If they're not working two or three jobs in order to make ends meet, they can come to the school and see about them. And so I look at it from that perspective. Why don't we take a look at manning this project in a way where we're going to have people of color over there benefiting from some of the work that's going to be there in this whole order of the day. So I would say that we just need to take a look at, as people, as a community, making sure that people are following the laws around some of those diverse aspects of rights and people working in there, and not just have people front for these are the jobs for people, and yet they're really not jobs for the people. So we should actively see people of various cultures working on that building as it gets put apart there. And it actually should be some really strong, I think, rules and regulations and someone actually manning that project.
Thank you. There's a reason for our madness, if you will. And on this next question, black educators facing challenges. And we were trying to be politically correct, so we didn't put up there black educators facing challenges and threats. But the fact of the matter is, Mr. Randolph said something very interesting during her dissertation about, it's not about the building, you know, it's about what we are going to do, the kind of stand we're going to take. Unfortunately, retaliation is not limited to the Middle East. What you're seeing over the last 9 days in Cairo. There are consequences, unfortunately, in America for those that speak out for their rights and for their freedom. Consequently, the question, retaliation, suspension, layoffs, firings, demotions, yes. I can see as someone who knows and understands what happens at 807. Sergeant, you respond.
Hey, I'll be glad to take that. Being the recipient of some of these kinds of situations, I would say that yes, 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 and that we really need to take a look at checking ourselves, and we really need to stand together and understand what's going on here, because as our children are in these schools, if we're constantly getting bombarded with retaliation, if we're getting demotions, if we're getting all kinds of feedback that borders on institutional racism, the kids see it. They know who's in power. What do you think they're going to do? Okay? So I think that we have to really, really take a look at that. And we really ought to look at our workforce, the diversification within our buildings. Who's in our buildings working? Why don't we have some diversity there? You know, we've gone so far backwards with diversity, and so to me, nothing will change until we deal with the institutional racism, talk about it, keep it out front, and make sure that we're moving our kids in a way that's going to be positive so that they can see that we do have some power in this city.
Ms. Whitman.
Again, as a community educator, I sway from the regular retaliation because I choose my contracts. I choose who I want to work with, and I choose the children to be with because they need us there. They need us to be there to make a difference, and they can't pull my license because I say we need to get them at the core of the issue that brought us to the situations that we find ourselves in the first place. And I'm not here to blame or shame anyone. I'm here hopefully to make a difference in the way we view each other, the way we work together as a community, and the way we truly work to the heart of the children and mothers and fathers in this community. Thank you.
Thank you. President Salzman?
Yeah, and I'm going to follow along with that. I think that we all need to stop pointing fingers at each other and at the situation. If we start to sticking together as adults, as educators, as communities, as organizations and businesses, I think we can resolve a lot of issues. We need to be able to put these things on the table without pointing fingers at one another. One of the things that bothers me so much as I go into the schools is to hear that and consistently be inundated with it. And sometimes I even want to yell at the top of my voice, just stop and shut up. And let's sit down and negotiate this like educated adults. And then we'll move forward.
I would be less than honest if I didn't say that racism and prejudice exist in our schools today. I'm in a suburban school district. It exists. People don't like to talk about it, especially leaders, because you won't get promoted, or they'll find another job for you to do. You won't be able to be on particular committees that you would like to be on because they know you'll be too vocal. You're bringing up too much data. You will challenge what is being said. I also know that if you are the minority, you are the Afro-American over a Caucasian staff, they unite and they sabotage what you do. They talk about all the things that you're not doing, that you're incompetent, that you're really not an effective principal. And where's the support from the district office? Are they there? Or do you feel like I should quit because this is too much? I don't have to deal with this. I can go into another profession. That's what black educators are facing. We need to have the support from the very high, from the governor, the MDE, the superintendent, the school board especially, when we know that teachers are fighting change. Teachers like it the way it is.
You can walk.
I'm sorry. My only teaching experience has been in contract schools in the urban area, and I haven't experienced this. As education chair of the education committee in NAACP, if something like this comes across our table, I'm looking forward to being able to address and would probably call on people up here to help me look into that issue.
In reference to black educators and suspensions, I can't speak to that for any district. I am a native of Bostonian, and I am very proud of that, but it also gives me privilege to some unique experiences. And so I always believe that we have to approach things from a historical perspective. And once again, as much as things change, they remain the same. And when I talked to you earlier about African Americans choosing education and to become educators, that's what builds the black middle class. We sit here because of African American educators, and yet many of them were forced after desegregation to choose other professions because of unions and other things. They had to choose other things, and so now we sit yet again at a point where now we need those black educators in the building. So I'm not so much worried about the suspensions and firing. I'm worried about how can we retain and how can we encourage young people to love learning and want to inspire and teach the next generation.
Ms. Gagnon, before you answer on practice, because
yes,
you are our only elected school board public official on the panel, and of course we have one other, my longtime friend, Richard, back there.
let me kind of put you on the spot.
Okay.
Because a couple of people kind of indicated a certain change in this. Do you believe that these particular features exist? Retaliation, suspension, layoffs, unfair firings, and a second in the Mass Public School District?
I can't say that I haven't been given examples of them happening. I haven't seen it myself, and I'm not naive enough to believe that it doesn't. I think institutional racism, albeit a very hard concept to understand, it's easy to identify, but incredibly difficult to erase. Many African-American teachers who are hired, there are still people who might believe that they were hired just to increase diversity numbers as opposed to merit. And the same with, I've seen people meet young men, young African-American men who say they're going to college, and some people might assume athletic scholarships. So that type of mindset creates a much more uphill battle for our teachers of color, who almost have to just work harder and prove themselves more to be accepted into the network.
Thank you. And before I turn it over to my associate and colleague, Mr. Allen, I must indicate to you that there is a historical genesis for this question being posed. And part of that history is in this room in the form of Professor Francine Chakotas, who I hope will, during the Q&A, take the opportunity to talk about the reality of this particular proposition in question. Because she was long in the forefront of the courage and massy of long ago to speak up on this issue.
Black children need to see teachers that look like them. How are schools going to close the achievement gap when students don't have any teachers of color? Last hired, first fired. This article came out last year on News One. Secretary Duncan said black male teachers need it. And I guess my question would be to the panel. We'll start with Ms. Bonds on our way down. And what are you going to do to change that? I mean, what are some of the solutions for that that you can put out to our audience and also to our listening audience, please?
Well, I think it's really simple. You change it by, as the panelists at the end say, you need to, and we need to recruit teachers of color, administrators of color, younger ones, bridging that gap between those who are entering into the profession and those that are already there. And not use a strategy where we're dividing those two, the ages. You need the wisdom, but you also need the youth. As a matter of fact, that was part of my work when I worked at Central Office. I put together Teachers of Color's program. That was something that I fought for many years, to keep in the Fund One budget and get it off of those grants and those. I had to raise funds for it, you know, and luckily back during those days, the legislature, they funded us with money for those programs, but when that money dries up, it's gone. So where is our commitment? So my thing is, I would say, let's get that in our Fund One budget and keep it there from now on. That's the only way to resolve that issue.
Ms. Whitney, please.
I would say that, for me, peer mentors from the educators to teach the children to do what it is they're doing, job shadowing, these kinds of things are of huge interest to students and kids of all colors. And again, it's not a color thing, it's a undereducated thing. And everyone needs to be educated. And the more we work and the more we do, the better things will change. And that's my opinion.
Thank you, Ms. Whitney. President Salisbury, please.
Well, you know, one of the issues I would like to address, and I know most people don't know this about me, but I'm the Director of Security for the University of St. Mary's here in Minneapolis, and that I also reserve teach part-time in the public school systems. I also have a K-12 principal's license as a reserve teacher. I have an EDS. I just passed the exam for my doctoral's comprehensive exam. And I cannot find, a hearing in the employment of Minneapolis schools as a leader. And I say this to you now, the reason I'm sitting here as the president, and I wanted that, because they wouldn't let me in the doors the way that my education would allow me. So I'm coming in the doors for our children any way that I can.
All right.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas,
I think we need to start thinking outside the box. We have a system that hires people of color, but they are the first that gets the pink slip when spring comes because of seniority. Thinking outside the box means you're going to make a commitment, you're going to make a policy in your district that we are not going to release effective teachers of color, because that's what the research says that we need. Now, you're going to have to fight to make sure that happens. Where are the parents? Parents should be demanding this. Community members should be demanding this. We want representation. It does influence kids, their behavior, and academically. On the other hand, we also want someone who really cares about the students, can make that connection, and we have those who are not people of color that have made great connections with kids. But the biggest need right now, change the system, make that mandate, we're going to keep you. We're going to hold on to you, and we're going to take the heat. Hear me, school board?
I think one way we can bring in more teachers of color is through, I've been working with this one group. It's a national group, Breakthrough Collaborative, and it partners private schools with public school districts. And they have a twofold mission. One is to take public school students who have an opportunity to go on to college, who would probably most likely be one of the first in their family to go on to college, and they give them extra summer and weekend enrichment opportunities. But their other mission is to take high school and college-age students who are teaching these students for a couple reasons. One is the middle school students respond a little easier with the teachers who are closer to their age. But there's a private school in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I know one thing that they try to do is make sure that their teaching faculty, their high school and college-age students, match the diversity within the public schools that the students are coming from. And so we train, and a number of those students say, after my experience here in this Breakthrough Collaborative, I've decided I want to go into teaching. And if we have teachers or students who are learning how to be teachers who represent, come from the same, are just as diverse as the public school students they would be working with. I think that's a step in making sure that students see themselves and their teachers.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ellison. Ms. Randolph, please.
Again, I guess I would just like to bring some other things to our attention. In terms of teacher retention, this is also happening at the college level. We're losing African-American educators who are teaching any number of things in college, and they're losing their jobs. So if you are in an education of college or teaching college, even if there's no African-American teachers there or even in that institution, that encourages you to consider that, you know, you're a good leader. You have all of these attributes. Have you thought about education? Some of our young men and women who are being engineers or nursing, you can do multi-dual degrees. You know, African-Americans are great at that duality of consciousness. We need to encourage our children, and we need to encourage each other how to get African-American children. Let's stop talking high school. We need to reach children in middle school at the sixth grade. And I'll just compare it to nursing, where there's going to be a nursing shortage. Even United Healthcare, when I worked for them for a number of years, they're talking about a nursing program that they're going to go into the high schools and allow them to be exposed to the nursing program. Then, well, you're too late. Did they take 4 years of math? Did they take 4 years of science? Do they know what the prerequisites are? So we're not reaching children at the age is between 11 and 12 and looking at those leadership skills and telling them there when they're tutoring a friend or they're peer educating or mediating that you can be a teacher, look at your gifts. I don't know why they would choose that as a profession if we truly don't value it.
Thank you. Director Gaggett.
Thank you. Our children need to see to believe. Our children need to have people to look up to see the possibilities. And I tell my oldest daughter, youngest daughter this, who they look to, not the people on the cover of magazines, but strong women shows the possibilities that we have. And right currently we are not providing that to many, many, many of our students of color. I can't speak to the retention rate. I know that it is tenured teachers do get laid off. We need to work with the colleges and universities and figure out how are you guys getting students of color in there, St. Mary's, and guiding them to the important art of teaching. And then we need to get them into the public school system by making them believe that we do need them and we value them, and they are going to make a bigger difference to our children.
Thank you very much, Director Gagnon. Before we get into the community Q&A part, where you come to the microphone and ask your question of the our panels tonight, I'd like to thank Ms. Freeman, who is the director, who is just standing there. Well, she's not here. We're going to thank Ms. Makeda Zulagutsi back there. Thank you. She's in this wonderful facility here. I mean, you were there. It was an easy call. Also, you are able to hear me tonight in this building because of the man behind me, Mr. Odell Hopkins, available for your event. He was nice enough at the last minute to bring his speakers, his microphones, and plug in everything so that we could broadcast live on the air to our listeners on Blog Talk Radio. And we'd like to thank our international listeners for tuning in. And we're going to continue this with the question Q&A section, or part. Would anybody like to come up and ask? Go ahead, Mr. Parker. And you have 1 minute to ask a question. You know how many of those we've been at? And you get up there. I went to school about 8 miles in barefoot. Yeah. Question, please.
It's a three-part question, though. The first part is, no matter what your opinion on, you know, the achievement gap, because, like, my daughter went to Minneapolis for 13 years and was never given algebra. So if she's never given that level of math to build upon, then it doesn't matter whether that kid is bright or not. They're still not going to understand something they've never been taught or nothing they've been exposed to. And the second part is, you know, as we talk about the community not being engaged, I look at our district because that's the one I'm familiar with. We have 3 to 4 attorneys sitting in the community or diversity office that's supposed to address us. We're overpaying attorneys to sit in there and use the law of the nation to keep us out of the school district. Come on, man. What's your opinion on that?
Let me just say this. You know, you're absolutely correct in that assertion. And we have to look at other things, too. We have to look at the process of the legal system in Minnesota as a whole when it comes to that. Because the human rights offices, the EEOC, and all of these, and I don't send out a message to start a war with those individuals, but justice ought to be served, and especially in education. It ought to be neutral, and there should be no race in it. And if you're standing there to ensure that the federal laws of this nation are followed, then we need to hold them accountable. We can't just look at the districts. We got to look at those offices that are government offices that are not doing their job. And I will tell you this, I filed a suit against the district some time ago, 4 years ago, and it disappeared in the human rights. And I am totally qualified to be a principal in the district of Minneapolis, and I have 2 kids in this district. So we have to look at not just the attorneys that's sitting in the office at 807. We need to look downtown, and we need to look uptown, and we need to look in St. Paul and bring this thing to an end.
I have a question, but more so everybody talks about problems, and I have a possible solution. I just want to know your opinion on it. I've worked with the public school system as a contractor for 15, 20 years. I work with special ed and kids, and I see one strain that has been ignored, and I think it's the key, history. The curriculum is barren from the true history of the African American. And I think, and I want to know what your opinion is, that if we were to really talk about the African American in America, what exactly happened to him or her, I don't see any kid that wouldn't want to pick up a book and read. But I think it's the absence and the go along, the get along, and okaying these milquetoast curriculums and not empowering us, you know, making us look very domesticated, almost like slavery was a good thing and we liked it, and the struggle was just one or two pages, and I have a dream and that's it, and not discussing the other parts of history. Our kids are smarter than we think they are, and when they see educators play around in denial and go along to get along, then they play the game, and then the parents play the game, or if the parent comes to the school with a legitimate issue that deals with race, and the educator goes, well, you know, and says, well, you see it, I see it, the kids know who's in power. When will we take our history serious enough to implement it in the curriculum so that a kid will know what happened, how they was not allowed to read, how they were not allowed to stay together as a family, how they were tortured to vote, and all these other things. And it seems like the kids don't know it, so they have a false degree of entitlement, like they're just supposed to have it, and they like everybody else, and that is not the case.
Would someone like to take that, maybe one or two?
Thank you for asking that question. I would agree with you. As I said earlier, the kids are watching us, and they understand what's going on. And to be very honest with you, we think the parents are not watching us in the Minneapolis public schools, but they are. And they will exit us, and they will do something else with their children. In terms of that history piece, historically, there were kids, let's say 22 years ago, when I was at Southwest High School, that was a big battle around that history piece and teaching African-American history. And I had Vince De La Silla to come in and teach some African-American history. And during that time, there was a great push to bring that forth. But because of, you know, people wanting to get along, go along to get along, then as that trend continues, then this is what happens. Unfortunately, you're absolutely right. And we don't have a big self-esteem piece here anymore. I was looking at some literature, and that's one of the missing links with our kids. They don't see themselves in the schools. There's been a dwindling presence of African-American men and women in the schools. And so they can't see it. They can't reflect upon themselves being there. There's this mirror, and it doesn't look like them, and so they do reject that.
I wanted to comment on that the history books let me start over. This is a national issue. It might even be an international issue, and I do not talk to students, and some of them don't want you to talk to them from the reference of the experience here, and I would agree. My legacy is not a slave legacy, but that's all we want to talk to our children about, from which that's where they come from, and that is all the experience that they have in this country. And so if you're not putting that in the history books, I don't care, but I don't want a physician operating on my eye if he's a podiatrist. So I don't want just anyone teaching my child African-American history. You have to be qualified. And we already have an issue of African-American teachers who are in the school system. I just don't know that I would go that route. However, it is essential, but I believe that to an extent that is community-based. And then another point is that we have to admit to ourselves that any of our institutions that we have in our community, and my child is the benefit of Harvard Preparatory School and Seed Academy when I first came here, but no one institution is going to give our children what they need, not a Montessori, not a private, not a parochial, not a public. And what we have done is a disservice to ourselves is that we believe that a school system and administrators, their job is to fully educate our child. That is the first mistake that we make. It is only part of their experience. So I agree that the history book, it should be in there correctly. And even listening to NPR on the road, there was a new textbook that came out. There was misinformation about African Americans. The mother was a professor. She called them on and they told her, well, we're going to have a new edition, but it's right for right now.
Okay. And before you say anything real quick, excuse me one second. I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Josie Johnson here in the audience.
Yeah.
Give her a hand. Yeah, I'm so glad that she came in. I have to give her a hug and say Happy New Year and get a good job with Governor Dayton.
I agree with Matthew when you say that education is a civil right, and I look at the history of African Americans in Minneapolis public schools. We have more children that are failing than are succeeding in Minneapolis, and we still asking and begging for somebody to take care of us. If I look at the history of civil rights in the 60s, we didn't ask, we demanded. We know they can do whatever they wanted. When Peter Hutchinson didn't have a license, they magically created one for him. I've known John since I met him almost 10 years ago. He was a reserve teacher. And we need black males. So my question to MAPSE, my question to our community, my question to the school board is, for those of you who say that this isn't about race, I'm where are you? Take the blinders off. It definitely is about race. Because if it wasn't about race, how come so many of us are failing, but the majority of the money is coming from our children? So I'm saying and asking you, MAPSE, I'm asking the school board, I'm asking the NAACP, if indeed this is a civil right, what are you going to do about it in terms of making sure that concrete action begins to happen now for our children?
I think I will. Thank you. This was the beginning of this because we realized that when we started to reorganize MAPSE and doing this forum, that there was a need. There was a need for someone to advocate for our children, for our teachers, for our community. And I personally acknowledge that this is a national organization. We are an affiliate of a national organization, and you are absolutely correct. I cannot sit and say that race is not an issue. I've been victimized by it in many ways. But I will not make that the criterion for how we move forward. You know, somehow we got to encompass the conversation of bringing all of us in, and especially when we're talking about education. And if we say education is a civil right, that means education for all children, everyone. It makes no difference whether they're in special needs, whether they are African-American or Asian-American, and if a blue child show up, we ought to teach them, too. So, thank you.
All right, I would like a blue child to show up.
A long while ago, white folks thought it would be a great idea to just say, let's be colorblind. Let's be colorblind and treat everybody the same. And in theory, I mean, it sounded great because it sounded like then we were going to do away with racism. But what we did is we made everybody behave like us and be like us, and that was acceptable. And so what we are missing, again, is the cultural component and the cultural competency and the absolute belief that every child can achieve.
Okay, thank you. Just a minute, sir. We have three more people. You're next.
The lead in the buildings that they go to. So they coming from a home like that and going into a home like that, they only gonna become sicker. And we all know what that does to the mind. And that's why I have a caseload who trying to get their kids right. And I think if we don't use our power as community, I'll be the, okay, man, I'm going to do that's one of my missions up there. To use our power as taxpayers. You don't teach our kids. You don't get our kids. And the one thing I also believe is for us to buy these homes, if it's possible, now because there's the Bible. But they're not going to stay there. If we can just do that, we'll have places for our families as well.
Thank you. Thank you. We have time for two more questions. This gentleman right here. And we got time for two more questions because we have to be out of here at 8 o'clock. Okay, so go ahead.
So my statement is twofold. One, I heard, I think Ms. Randall talk about inspiring as well. When we talk about education, I look at it twofold. One, I look at it as an information base. And then two, I look at it as an inspiration base as well. Because I think that a lot of times when our kids get in mess, we correct them. But no one's there to tell them, now here's what you can become, or here's what you can do now after that. A lot of times the human being is a very complex being, so there's no simplicity to a human. So when you tell me that there's an achievement gap or that it can't be achieved, I don't believe that. That's impossible. It's impossible for any human to be simple. And as African Americans, we have to stop comparing ourselves to anyone but ourselves. I'm really kind of sick and tired of comparing ourselves to everyone else. We are a brilliant and a peculiar people. And so what we have to do as African-American males, educators, teachers, is, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we have to learn to give information and inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's our Charles. Roger, the gentleman, let Charles and you, sir, and then Mr. Fairball up here. And that'll be the last questions because of time constraints, but this is not the only time I'm going to do this.
So we have to be out in the room by 8 o'clock.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes,
we did take you off the list, sir. My name is Chaz Dillon. I'd like to say good evening to the panel. One of the questions I have, how ironic that one of my mentors, Mother Francine Jacobus, is in the room, and we're talking about black students. I'm a graduate of Minneapolis Public Schools, and without a single woman in this room here, I would have never graduated from high school here. So I had one in my corner. They made a difference for me. My question to some of the panelists are, it is a catastrophe for children of color, and I am concerned about, you know, we're talking about getting black kids into school. What about keeping black kids into school when, especially in the last couple of years now, we've had up to 500 suspensions for kindergartners? I mean, come on, I'm serious. A lot of folks might not be aware of that. You know, let's try to keep the kids in school first. So I'd just be curious to hear what you think.
Yes, we're going to give you 1 minute to respond, and we're going to ask Ms. Randolph and then Ms. Thomas. Thank you.
I can't speak for all schools, but I know that in some of the Minneapolis public schools, there are a lot of other things that are happening prior to that. We do have a lot of Northsiders who are Minneapolis graduates who are working in our schools. We have some educators who went to Minneapolis public schools and our teachers. And I think it's through those jewels that are in our building and through us thinking about the creative part of our children and understanding, okay, it's not just information, it is inspiration, and we are trying to use some of those creative ways to redirect children instead of punitive measures, which is not part of our culture anyway.
Thank you, Ms. Ms. Thomas, please.
I mentioned earlier that we have to think outside the box. Instead of sending kids home where the parents are working. There's no one there to monitor them, and they're probably not at home, or if they are at home, they're on Xbox and all those other kind of toys. Have a center where you send these kids where they can learn how to behave, where they can learn what is acceptable, to learn how to deal with conflict, to learn how to communicate appropriately, to learn how not to be abusive and bully other kids. So I think we have to come up with another setting to help the kids, almost like special education. You know, we don't send all our special education kids home when they act out. We have a special area for them, and we work with them, and that's what should happen. I mean, leaving little kids out like that, not okay.
Thank you.
Rob, you ready?
Yes, sir.
My name is Virgie Gregoire, and I have 40 years of experience in designing curriculum and training teachers. The public schools do not train children to learn. What they do is train children to acquire information. That's not learning. Nothing in the public schools since 1903, which is the school system we now have, is designed to do everything perfectly as it's done now. We don't have an achievement gap. It was designed for our children not to achieve. So the fault is in the school system. The fault is in the school system and the teachers that are trained to perpetuate the school system, which in fact destroys our children by the time they reach the first grade.
Yes, that's true.
So let me be explicit about it. The basic basic structure of cognitive development, that is the ability to think clearly and independently for oneself, begins at the moment one establishes a sense of self. But the public schools, by the time a child reaches the first grade,
yes,
has annihilated in every child, black and white, the notion that they have an independent self. No doubt in my mind, after 40 years, that the school systems are teaching children what to think, not how to think.
Yes, sir.
That's indoctrination. I disagree with so much of what was said on the panel, because to think that we have an achievement gap when every child is born as the learning animal, we are the learning animal. Every human being born to learn. They don't have to teach us how to learn. We learn naturally from the moment we're born. And one quick point, reading. Reading and the reading programs in the school system annihilates a child's sense of self, because it should begin with a child writing, not reading. Because writing establishes one's identity to the outside world of who I am. But if you start reading somebody else's book without knowing what it means, you acquire the literacy of the larger society without acquiring your own identity.
Last question, Mr. Fairfall, before the call's out here. Or last comment. Justin. Well, this is what I want to say to the panel, and as a parent who have raised kids in the school system and put a parenting committee together, I know a lot of the ladies and gentlemen around here for fighting with the system, is that I find it very, very interesting that we would blame the kids instead of putting the blame on why are we educating these parents. You can't move anywhere if you don't know how that system works. That's why you have your special programs. You have kids mislabeled. You have parents and teachers fighting because we're not speaking the same language. How can you expect to do anything if they're not communicating with each other? I've heard people on the panel talk about your credentials. That's fine and dandy, your credentials. But when it comes back to the community, if you're moving and your community's not moving, what's the point? Because you keep moving. But if we die, you're not here anyway.
Thank you.
Miss Jolie Johnson, because you said that, ma'am, come here. I listen, I obey.
My question is, you know, I've been listening to everybody in the room, and I'm one of the younger people in the room, and my good old copy, he taught me a lot of things you hear will be nothing more than old soup warmed over. And a lot of the things that we've been discussing, we've been dealing with this for years. When I was young, going to Saturday sleep, listening to him, I remember when I interviewed Josie Johnson and Katie McGuire years ago about the desegregation of schools. And God rest her soul, came to watch. She left one thought with me, and she said, one of the biggest things, I said, if you can go back and change anything, what would it be? She said, I would not desegregate the schools. So my question to the panel is, how long should we sit here and beg the school system to teach our children? How long should we sit here and beg people to do things that we know how to do ourselves? When do we stop going to them and say, let's build our own institution, not just, you know, some little charter schools, no discount to the charter schools, but build up some schools where, you know what, then they'll start coming to us. Because if you take the dollars away, because like someone said, the money is on our children, then we'll get their attention. So my question is to the panel for that.
Who'd like to take that? I have, can I give you a minute there?
Well, I will start, I will end where I started with answering that question. We need to collaborate with organizations throughout the state of Minnesota. If we are going to find a solution, it's going to take all of us. We need to start to volunteer in our time. If you are parents, if you are teachers, you know, spend the extra time to make sure we get this thing to an end. You know, I was in Ramsey the other day as a reserve teacher, and I went to the principal and I said to her, you know what? You don't have to just have me in here as a reserve teacher. If you find something that I can do to help these children, you don't have to pay me. So I'm saying to you, it takes all of us. We all need to get on board, though we will continue to be saying this 20 years down the road.
Okay, I would like to, well, we're going to close off because we have less than 4 minutes here. I'd like to thank Director Gagnon, Ms. Nicole Randolph, Ms. Kim Ellison, thank you very much, Ms. Diane Thomas, President Salisbury, Ms. Mary Whitney, thank you very much, and Ms. Hattie Bond. If any of the if you are educators out there in the audience and you'd like to be a member of MAPSE, I would advise that you see Ms. Bond. She has some applications there. It's $40 a year. They meet once a month in South Minneapolis. And I think that everybody should be a part of this that's in this room. It's a very important piece. Also, this is not the only time that we're going to have a panel like this with the members of MAPSE and some ringers thrown in. But we're going to do this on the south side of Minneapolis also. So with that said, you've been listening the last 2 hours to On Point on Blog Talk Radio. Tune in this Saturday where we kind of we're going to do a recap on this and have some of the MAPSE members call in. We appreciate it. I'm your host, Don Allen, with Mr. Ron Edwards. Thank you very much and have a great day.